Hello, and welcome back to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff. Today we have with us a physician, Dr. Phyllis Hollenbeck, who has written a book called Sacred Trust. In it, she talks about the faith that patients put in their family physician, and that therefore the family physician holds as a sacred trust to help that person stay well. So she gives guidelines from the physician's perspective on ways that we can work better with our physicians. We hope that you will stay with us and join us for a very enlightening conversation with Dr. Phyllis Hollenbeck, a family physician from Washington State. Please stay with us now. We'll be right back after this message. The Powerful Patient is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. We work with people who are dealing with complex medical conditions or who may be struggling to get a diagnosis. We help you learn how to manage your health, form a partnership with your healthcare providers, and manage your healthcare team. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We welcome your questions either by email or by telephone at 1-800-767-4845, extension 6. Thank you.
Tell me about your background a little bit. I understand you're from Boston.
Originally, yes, except for a couple of years before the age of 8 in New York City. But so I briefly was a Yankees fan, I think. But once you become a Red Sox fan, it's in your bone marrow. So
right.
Spent the rest of until right through high school in the Boston area, and then went to school for undergraduate at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. And the key thing in my formation as both a person and definitely as a physician was that Brown has and had a pre-med liberal arts program. Mm-hmm. So I was an English major in pre-med, so I was able to use my two main interests and merge them, and then stayed at Brown for medical school also.
Very good.
And then trained in my specialty choice, since doing family medicine or primary care well is a specialty unto itself, mm-hmm. It takes a certain kind of mind that likes to see the big picture and specify things for certain people, but look across the range of ages and genders and what's going on in that whole enterprise in front of you. And so I picked family medicine for my choice in medicine.
That's great. Yeah, one of the things that I noticed about your book is that you seem to be saying from the doctor's side the same kind of things that I'm saying from the patient side, that patients need to take charge and be willing to say to your doctor, you know, this is not really a good fit. maybe I should find a different doctor.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because sometimes I think we're better consumers of car repair services than we are of healthcare services. You know, if you walked into a car repair shop and they said, oh, you need a new Dumaflachi and it'll cost you $3,000 and we'll do it, you know, you can pick it up at two. Would you write that check?
I mean, but if somebody says that to you in the medical office, people don't, you know, right now with the way we pay for insurance, people don't write the check. But a lot of times people are, I think, unduly grateful for the fact that somebody who they have great respect for and who they trust implicitly is deigning to do something for them.
Hmm.
And that is, it's so backwards. You know, I've had people tell me, you know, other radio interviewers and other print interviewers say to me, well, people feel like they can't talk to the doctor, you know, and question as much because it's like trying to talk to God. Mm-hmm. And that's a scary misconstruction because once you have that in your head, never mind that it's completely false and impossible, but once that's in your head as a patient, you are intimidated from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And you just can't be yourself. And if you can't be yourself, you can't tell your story. And the story is from what all the diagnosis and all the caring and all the treatment flows from.
Right. Right. I think 50 years ago, we did have doctors on a pedestal, and we both cultivated, both the patients and the doctors cultivated this myth that doctors sit at the right hand of God, and you really can't argue with the doctor because, after all, it's a realm that you know nothing about. But just like I know nothing about car repair services, but I'm sure it's going to push back on somebody that I think may be taking me for a ride. And I don't think doctors are going to take me for a ride. It's just that it is a technology that I don't understand. And if this is one person's opinion, is this the right opinion? I guess having dealt with complex medical conditions for more than 40 years, I perfectly understand that two well-meaning, very well-trained physicians can have two very different perspectives on the same problem. And it's not that either one of them is wrong, it's just that they have two different perspectives. And as a patient, it's important for me to hear those perspectives before I make a life-changing decision.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that people don't do is they don't say the first thing that comes to mind is the normal question or response to, say, somebody in a car repair shop who says, this is what it is and this is what you need. You would actually say, most of us, I think we've gotten to the point where we can say, and I've trained my teenage daughter to say this when she's all by herself, if something happens to the car, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. And or that doesn't feel right. And those are the kind of things that people need to say to their doctors, especially if you're at that first doctor before you go for that second opinion in the case you were, kind of cases you were describing. You want to be able to say, that just doesn't sound right to me, or I didn't understand the way you presented it.
Or
I need you to come back at it again.
Right. Or are there any other options?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I had breast cancer in 1979, and I went to a surgeon who did the lumpectomy, and I came back to his office to talk about what to do next, and he said, you know, I think you need a modified radical mastectomy. But, he said, I have to tell you, I'm a surgeon, and I look at the world through a surgeon's glasses.
Exactly. They trained
to
cut. And
if I were you, I'd want to talk to people with some other perspectives.
Well, he has the right stuff. God bless him.
Yeah.
I tell people, surgeons are cutters.
Yeah.
That's what they love. And that's why we need the people to go into that who love that, who really don't want to be putting it all together from other directions or being the captain of the ship of the whole person. And I know when people will come in and they'll want to see, or they wonder about seeing an orthopedist for knee pain. And the whole thing is to work through what's the reason for the knee pain. And then to remind people that if you need physical therapy and time for your knee to heal, the orthopedic surgeon doesn't want to see you, you know, nice as a person as they may be. And they basically are going to see you and decide whether you need surgery or not.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't, and they'll send you to their physical therapist. So people forget that. You were lucky enough, and it's a shame you have to say lucky enough because it should be the norm, that he was aware of the research that goes back a little bit of time now, but doesn't go back far enough. It certainly wasn't there in the beginning of my career 30 years ago. And it said there were other equally reasonable alternatives for early-stage breast cancer. And there was still a lot of controversy about that because mm-hmm. there was that hidebound, you know, mindset. And it was mostly, you've touched on the you know, sexism. And that's in medicine, and still in certain people to this day. Mm-hmm. But people who thought, you know, these are men that know what to do best with women's breasts. And until we got more women in the field and more research being done by women, there wasn't as much of a push to say, hey, this is an amputation if we take a breast off. That's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Is it making any difference in life outcome, in treatment outcomes?
Right. Right. Yeah, I've always appreciated the wisdom of his approach. And he handed me a piece of paper and said, you know, go talk to this radiation oncologist and this person about chemotherapy. And then come back to me in 2 weeks and we'll talk about it. And I went back to him in 2 weeks and I signed up for the modified radical mastectomy.
Mm-hmm.
But I had done my homework, and I think this is the critical point, and I share this story a lot with people, that I realize now in retrospect that I needed to do that homework. I needed to know what my options were and go through the thought process of deciding on my own that for me, for who I was at that moment in time, the right approach for me to take was the modified radical mastectomy. When, as you say, there were other legitimate approaches, but it's enabled me to read the women's magazines for the last 30 years and not recriminate with myself,
right,
and not recriminate with my doctor.
Right, exactly. And it needs to be said also, it's wonderful that you're here and alive and well, and that you're doing well after a cancer diagnosis, because it's horrifically scary. You know, like time stops in your face when you hear those words.
Right.
I think that the saddest thing is to see somebody, and I certainly saw a lot of women in the first 10 years of my career who had had hysterectomies, and many of them didn't know exactly why.
Mm-hmm.
And it made my blood boil, you know, inside. And on the other hand, these were people who sometimes when you asked, just taking their history, you know, what surgeries and why did you have this, and they would start to cry when they got to the hysterectomy because it was still a wound, an open wound.
Right.
So the worst thing is to take away from somebody that sense of, I do have this one body. They use those in commercials all the time about, you know, one body, one life. I'm going to take one pill a month for my bone density. But the using the phrase that way is missing the deeper point of you only have one self that comes into the world. It's body and soul. It all has to be respected and treated with great care by patients who need to, you know, be willing to take walks to help their diabetes, but also by every person that touches it and comes into contact with you in the medical and the healing arts, because it's sacred.
That's so right. And I think we need to not just be subservient to the doctor, but try to create a partnership with the doctor. You need that doctor's expertise. They did go to medical school. They have a lot of experience and perspective that you don't have. And we need that on the team. But at the same time, you live with your body all the day.
Exactly.
And so your perspective ought to be worth something.
Yeah, you are
18 seconds.
Exactly. You are the boss of you. You know, you live inside that body all the time. And I tell patients, one of the things I do when I, you know, go into a room, and I was trained to do it. I was trained to do this with my manners with my parents, not just by good teachers in medical school, but it was to come in with a welcome expression, even if it was a sad situation, but something that knew you wanted to be helping this person. And you introduce yourself, obviously, if it's a new patient. And if I'm not sure how to pronounce their name, I'll say, I'm going to give it a go here. You know, with a smile on my face, because then they know I'm going to try to do my best.
Right.
And if I screw it up, and they'll say, oh, but that's no problem. And I'll say, no, it's your name. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to have it pronounced the way you want to.
Right.
So let me do it some honor. And I think I'm more comfortable with that kind of tone. I'm not comfortable when somebody else is uncomfortable in the room with me. And I don't think that doctors who don't understand how to set the stage, open that partnership, I think that they are very unhappy in the exam room. I think people know they're unhappy. Everybody who crosses their threshold knows they're with somebody who isn't present with them.
Mm.
So I think it's sad to think they're out there. Some of them shouldn't be in medicine, and some of them should be really trying to figure out how to do it better, because if somebody is uncomfortable in the exam room, to me it's the saddest thing. I don't want people apologizing. I want them to understand I definitely can feel that someone respects me, and I do want that. I worked hard to put all this brain power out on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm dead serious about what I do. But I want people to understand that it's okay to laugh if something funny happens. There's no law against it.
Mm-hmm.
People think there is, almost. You know, they're afraid to do it. It's been almost worse than church. People won't laugh. And, and that, you know, humor is part of being human. And So I want people, I don't want people ever apologizing. I want them to be able to say, you know, Dr. Hollenbeck, I really like you, but what you just said makes no sense. You know, or if I've said something and I'm giving it my best and I'm translating between the Latin and the English, so the, you know, scientific word in the, I'm reading their face, finding how much I need to translate because some people know a great deal about medical terms, which right. makes it more fun because you start talking in a, you know, faster way about it. But I read their face, and if I get to the end of explaining, you know, here's why your kidneys aren't working as well right now with your diabetes, I say to them, people are very polite and they smile and they nod. And I can just tell when I look at somebody's face sometimes, they don't know. They really don't get it.
They just really hadn't gotten it.
They yeah.
were just smiling to be polite.
Exactly. Which, again, I don't want. It, to me, it's like crazy silly. You know, it's crazy silly. But it's not doing anybody any good.
Right.
I've failed. So I tell them, did anything I say kind of feel put together, and they'll finally, you know, if you lean forward with a smile, they actually feel they can say no. And then you say, I say, well, you know, then I let you down. I've screwed up here. I'm going to come at it from a different angle. And because it's very important that you leave here not confused. I'm not here to confuse you. I'm here to take care of you and help you take care of yourselves.
Part of it is the understanding. As you say, there's a big gap between the medical terminology, all that Latin stuff, and most people's level of understanding of it. But even if they didn't go to medical school, most people have a good deal of common sense. And usually if we translate it into some technology that they are familiar with, then they can get it, you know, plumbing or mechanical engineering or, you know, something that that they can relate to, then they can usually understand what's going on.
Oh, absolutely. And I talk in the book a bit about you explain kidney system dynamics differently to somebody who is an engineer
right.
who really thinks in that way. It's like teachers have to figure out what is the way this child learns.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're a physician, if you're seeing young children, then you're, you know, figuring out how that young person understands it. But everybody comes into the room with a great deal of knowledge and different ways of understanding. We should be able to explain just about anything, at least the basics of it, to anybody, even if it's through an interpreter, because we ought to at least get the big, be able to get the key points down. It's just such a, it's sacred work, and but somebody's life depends on it, so we need to do that. We need to understand that's the only thing that's acceptable. Mm-hmm. But everybody who comes into the room, whether they're in science, another science aspect or not, they do have a way of framing their life. And I know being somebody who loves words and languages and being at English, the famous English major, you know, those fabled English majors. I think Garrison Keillor just says that they're all in Minnesota and they're all depressed. But, but you know, some of us are trying to, you know, we're all sticking our pen to paper and trying to do something better in right. the world too. So, but coming from that framework where you're always trying to think, what does this mean? How can I say this to myself? How can I say this to somebody else?
Mm-hmm.
That's why being a liberal arts pre-med student is a great gift, because I know that there can be a graphic artist who comes in who has a way of understanding some concept I'm trying to explain, who could teach me something about how to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, that's when time stops in the room in a good way, because you're present and you're doing the thing you were here to do, and the person is being, feels like somebody really wants to help. And that's a simple, you know, dynamic there, but there isn't anything better in life.
When I was 19 and newly married, my husband had a brain tumor. And I went along as the, you know, patient advocate spouse, but 19 years old.
Yeah, that you're on shaky legs there.
Very
yeah.
shaky legs, especially in the 1960s.
Oh, God bless you.
So and most doctors would sort of pat me on the head and say, oh, she's going to be all right. And that, mm-hmm. of course, didn't satisfy me at all.
Good, good.
But I thought, you know, the best doctors will take the time to draw me a picture.
Right.
And as you're speaking, one of the memories that comes up for me is one of his eye doctors was talking about the eye surgery he had just done, and he said, and he came out of this with a sort of Mae West-shaped eyeball. And that phrase has just stuck with me. You know, the simple ways that people explain things, or the picture that they drew, and the time that they took to make sure that I was understanding it, was just wonderfully appreciated.
Yeah, and you know, they've always been out there, and they're not. It's not specific to gender. I hear a lot of stories about this guy is a jerk. You know, this position. There are still a lot more men practicing medicine than the numbers that go through school and hang in there, and there's many reasons for why women aren't getting to the top of running the culture of medicine, and therefore I feel changing it even more for the better. But I think that there can be, it's easier for a male physician if he goes to a certain kind of school and he's been brought up to think he's the prince. And then he goes out and he gets that MD degree. It's like being crowned for some people. And they get tone deaf to the signals all around them where people are unhappy and they're not comfortable with the care. And some of the patients switch, and because there's always a new patient. So they won't look at the feedback that's there, even if it's, you know, not being yelled at them and it's not on paper. They're not picking up the signals because they're not comfortable looking at themselves. So I think what you did took so much guts, and there have always been brave people through the, you know, couple of hundred years of American medicine who were able to stake their claim and stand their ground, but it shouldn't be hard, and I'm sure it was very hard for you. I can just picture you.
Well, as a matter of fact, the way I found out the medical information, my father was teaching anatomy at the University of Tennessee Medical School, and so I would write down my list of questions and call my father and say, will you please call this doctor at Columbia Presbyterian and ask him the following questions, and then get back to me. Why did my father call? And, of course, to him, they would tell him everything, you know.
Oh, sure.
Gruesome detail. And then I'd get the rundown from my dad. But that's not something that's open to everybody. I think it's not all male-female, too. I've seen women who are also tuned out to these issues. And I know, you know, having been one of the few women in high tech in the 1980s,
you're always breaking ground, aren't you?
Breaking ground. You know, I've done that all my life. But I remember there was one woman who was in my department who said that her recipe for getting ahead in high tech was that you never touched a coffee pot and you never touched a keyboard.
Well, the coffee part would work in internship in medicine, too.
Right. So, because otherwise the girls were always sent off for coffee. And then I read an article about Golda Meir, who was president of Israel.
Sure.
And she would entertain heads of state in her kitchen and serve them coffee and homemade honey cake. And I thought, this is a woman after my own heart. I mean, this is what, as you say, I was brought up to do, make people comfortable in my home. And you sort of disarm them when you do that. They'll tell you things they wouldn't tell across a formal boardroom table.
Exactly.
And in a doctor-patient relationship, that's exactly what you want. You want the real story, not just I have headaches, but tell me the story of when do you get headaches, what are they like, if it was a fruit or a vegetable, how big would it be? Mm-hmm. All those kinds of disarming things is how you get at the real story.
Oh, absolutely. And if you... Again, as I put in the book, because it was important for me to just get this out for posterity, you've got to be a person, to be a good physician, you have to be somebody who's just absolutely animated and thrilled and breathes and lives for the stories. Mm-hmm. And because that's what makes each person different. Now you want to be scientifically interested in it because you want to know is this headache the brain tumor that you might see every 2 years, or is it somebody who's, you know, they always get it at 4 o'clock by the time their boss has been yelling at them all day, and now they've got that tension headache. And either way, you want to help the person because they're in pain. So when you ask people to describe it, I love it because it's people say the most poetic and amazing and beautiful, and they have those Mae West kind of descriptions. You know, they describe something, or, you know, and they laugh, and, you know, they're, well, almost everybody has a way of saying something in their own words that is just spectacular. And they will say, you know, well, it feels like, gee, you know, if I tell you this, you're going to think it's crazy or stupid. And I say, no, no, I don't think so. Because first of all, I've been doing it 30 years. But besides that, I, you know, you're the first person that's come in, that's you, that's telling me this story. I love to hear the story. It's fascinating as a fellow human being, but it actually is often a couple of words that just leads you to the diagnosis eventually. And I could tell you story upon story, and even very briefly, a woman last year who had come in her 30s, and she actually had seen two other people over a couple of months, and she kept complaining of a feeling of a kind of a bubbling headache. That's how she described it. And it wasn't really in her eye. It was behind one eye, and she felt like it kind of went towards through to the back. Now, there's nothing off the top of the list that fits right in there. Mm-hmm. But she also had a lot of pressure around the right eye into the cheekbone. And one of the things to ask about, which hadn't really been leaned on very much because people got stuck on the bubbly headache, mm-hmm. and thought, oh, this woman must be crazy. And she was a woman under a lot of stress, woman in her 30s, husband traveled a lot. But she knew what she was talking about. It was her body. So I asked her about, you know, allergies and other things, and did she feel sinus pressure? And I said, well, I don't know. And, you know, she'd had it 6 months, and it hadn't rapidly progressed. So I said, I think we have a little time. If you're comfortable, let's look at the sinus pictures. Let's do some treatment for that. And I don't think we'll do this for, you know, 10 days to 2 weeks, but let's get some data on some things we can take a picture of, because I can't, you know, I'm not sure that we are going to need to do the MRI right now. I'm mm-hmm. not sure it's going to help me any more than getting more history and working with you on some treatment to make you try to feel better. So she was fine with that because I'd listened, and she did tell me later, you know, it was that feeling of a different kind of it was going to be a different kind of visit than the other two visits had been with some other people. So, and that's what you want to hear, not for your ego, but that I'm hitting the mark, that I'm doing my job as well as I can. Mm-hmm. So on the sinus x-rays, the very good radiologist noted that, yes, she did have chronic sinus and, you know, inflammation consistent with the untreated pollen allergies, but she did have some, just a little change in the shape of one sinus, and it was a very subtle thing. And he said, but, you know, I think it would be good if we did do the, you know, MRI views, and we'll do special ones because we've seen there are different details you can order, and we've seen this other change. And this, so we did that, and this woman had a very slow-growing surface brain tumor. And it was kind of leaning into, very, unluckily, there weren't any neurologic effects yet, mm-hmm. except for the funny headache, the bubbly headache. Right. But it was leaning exactly where she kept pointing. Hmm. All those months, and she, the reason the bubbly part fit in is because the sinuses are air-filled cavities in the mm-hmm. skull, and so that's why she was talking about it that way. But she knew she was exactly right.
Hmm. Right. When you have the regular garden variety headaches, they usually move around, right?
All kinds of things do. Yeah. The most common headaches are muscular contraction, and people think of those as tension, and they are related to outside tension or inside psychological tension. Mm-hmm. But basically, when we say tension in medicine, the word, and when you're learning it in physiology class, is about muscle contraction, you know, strength and what fibers do. Mm-hmm. So you can often, usually, you want to look at, you know, the times these occur. If you wake up with a headache first thing before you've even started to think of something you're worried about, that's a big difference. And that's something that you'd want to worry more about, it being something physically inside the skull or the brain. if it happens later in the day and you can touch the sore places, sometimes your whole scalp will feel like you have a hat on too tight and be sore all over. You can kind of find these trigger points. Sometimes it's just at your temples and the back of your neck where the muscles kind of insert into your skull, and you know that's where they start contracting and squeezing more. Migraines are, it's a term that's thrown around, but there's a specific constellation of symptoms with those. There can be family histories, and when you ask the right, you know, when you follow the story, you don't have to direct people. You do ask intelligent questions so that they're able to give you more of a story, because they don't know what parts of the story fit together or don't, and that's where being the physician comes in. Right. And then you can find out a great deal by the story, even on one visit. And you don't have to know the name of what might be going on, and it doesn't have to be one of these things with a big name. But you ought to have a sense of what are we dealing with, what system, what, you know, severity, and what could we do now today, either to make the symptoms better while we figure this out or to just fix it today.
Great ideas. Thank you. We'll be back in just a minute to talk more with Dr. Hollenbeck about how you can help your doctor diagnose your headache or other pain condition as rapidly as possible. So stay tuned. We'll be right back to speak some more with Dr. Hollenbeck.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
We're back now speaking with Dr. Phyllis Hollenbeck about her new book, Sacred Trust. And we're talking about how to help your doctor diagnose your headache or other pain condition.
It's good to get some perspective on pains, headache pain or pain anywhere, really, to know what time of day it occurred, after you had done what. All those pieces of information are very important, and you're not always going to remember those in the short doctor's visit. So probably keeping a log for a week before you get to the doctor might give you some more data for the doctor to look at.
Oh, yes. It's one of, you know, it's hard for everybody. Everybody's squeezed for time. It's a crazy culture.
Well, and I think we're programmed to forget pain.
Exactly. So people, you know,
Otherwise, people would only have one child.
That's exactly where I was going, because when I was in labor with my second oldest, and I remembered patients having delivered a lot of babies too, and people saying, oh, you know, you forget all about labor. And then I remember the woman who said, until the first contraction, the next pregnancy. And I thought, God, that woman was right. You know, put that in as another patient who, you know, was brilliant. And then there was a commercial on the radio in the car while I'm panting and breathing and telling my husband to hurry up on the way to the hospital. And there was a British actor doing a commercial and saying there were certain things that should always be rented. And one was cars, and one was, you know, party paraphernalia, and the other one was small children. And I'll never forget that, because I thought, oh, my God, I could have rented this. So it was, you're right about pain. And people are very, they're squashed for time. So it's hard to say, oh, when am I going to take time to write the list for the doctor? I do say to people, though, with headaches in particular, you hit right on it, keeping a headache log is a great help to me when we're trying to sort it out together. And that's because those are the things that, you know, they aren't that pain that comes every 2 weeks when you eat, you know, macaroni and cheese that might be your gallbladder. So headaches often have their own country of pain. So I think keeping the log is great. But when you get to the doctor for whatever you go in for, the right kind of physician, an excellent physician, and they everybody ought to be aiming for excellence, the key things to diagnosis are, when did it start? Does it go away? What makes it better? What makes it worse? How often do you have it? What happened? What were you doing before the first time it happened? I like to ask, what do you think it is? And, there are amazing stories I have with that, but many times people also will say, well, don't take this the wrong way, Dr. Hollenbeck, but my mother-in-law thinks it's my gallbladder. And I'll say, well, that's okay. You can say that because she might be right. And, so then you take more history and you do the exam. And I've said to people, when after I've done the abdominal exam, and they sit up again on the table, and I said, please, with my compliments, tell your mother-in-law, I think that's probably the number one diagnosis right now. And tell her, because I think that's wonderful. I don't know. That just makes me feel, I just enjoy that. I guess that's the simplest way to say it. Because it's fun when you know that there are other people thinking out there, and that the patient knows it's okay, that other people who care about them are thinking. What a concept, right?
Sometimes you've had a patient come in who's been through physicians before, have either discounted their opinion or given them the wrong diagnosis, and they come in with a stack of 3 inches of paper printouts from the Internet, and they say, I've been looking on the Internet, and I'm convinced I have, multiple sclerosis, or name a disease. So how do you react to a situation like that?
Well, you're right. It was multiple sclerosis is one of the scariest and one of those poorly understood to this day. So that's often one that people will come in with a lot more research on. Lyme disease has gone in and out of the consciousness as the big worry, chronic fatigue syndrome, and different names for similar conditions, because the symptoms are so broad that many things can be causing the same symptom. When people come in with a Manhattan phone book size, information printout, what I say to people is, and especially if it's a new patient, I tell them that first I want them to tell me the story, and what they think it is. And I'm very happy to look at the information, but I'll be honest with them, I can't do it right away. Right. I can't do it in front of them. There's no way I can read all this and absorb it. And I want to start with the person in front of me first. And if there's certain things they want to highlight for me to read first in the information, then that's where I'll start. And sometimes I can scan the information. If I see that people are going to sites that I know are well-meaning but kind of off the mark, I will tell them that. I will give them my best educated opinion of what I think of this site, or that this site is excellent, or I would actually go to the organization, for sufferers of this condition, and this is one I'd recommend, and a couple different ones, and then tell people to come back with more questions, and we'll continue the conversation.
I hear you handling it with respect, and I think that's the most important ingredient. Many times people tell me that the doctor just said, "Oh, please, let's do this the real way," and completely discount all the research that they've done. And I agree with you that you shouldn't accept a whole cloth or immediately start reading through all the data. That's not your role. But on the other hand, I think it's a symptom of this person's frustration and needs to be handled delicately.
Oh, absolutely. It's a symbol of, it's a sign of two things. One is that they're frightened to death. Mm-hmm. And that's very important, because that's a person in front of you who needs another human being to help bring the fear down as much as possible, and take action. I tell my kids, sort it out, prioritize it, don't catastrophize. So somebody else can help you not catastrophize, at least at that moment, and maybe put the brakes on the fear, so that we can sort things out and what can we do about it. It's also a sign that this is a patient. This is, a person who is intelligent and is trying to learn, and that's a person you can work with. Yeah. Because that's somebody who cares about what happens to them. It just doesn't occur to me to be disrespectful. I think if you're honest with people, and say, gee, I was an English major and I've read a lot of books, but I don't know how fast I can read this, and I'm getting older. So people understand that,
yeah.
but they do want you to care that they took the time to try to bring you something because, this is their life.
And they're desperately seeking answers.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And
you can help them toward those answers in a more constructive way. That's fabulous.
Yeah, and often when I ask people to show me one or two highlights, they will show me something that's either, it's not something that I shouldn't have heard of if it's a known condition. Hopefully I've been, something that I've heard a blip about or read a little bit about. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they are highlighting the part of their pain or condition that is the most worrisome to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that is important information for me as a person who's trying to help and diagnose and treat.
Right.
And that's what's so unconsciously fascinating about it. That's why that story and the back and forth of two people in the room is so key.
Right, right. Tell me what you consider the role of diagnostic tests.
Well, you mean the little ones or the big ones or everything in between? Or
about anything. At what point do you choose to order one and then what weight do you give it? I'll tell you what's running in my mind. I just interviewed last week a woman who has Lyme disease but came to that diagnosis after almost a year of going back and forth with her physicians, and they were working with her constructively, but that her particular body wasn't mounting the sort of defenses that most of the tests are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And so the test would come back negative, but in fact she did have Lyme disease, and it wasn't until they basically took a chance and put her on IV antibiotics, much to the chagrin of the hospital administrators, that she actually began to get better, and they began to realize that it was a flaw in her immune system that was causing these tests to come back negative. So their tests are not always perfect. They do their best job, but they all have room for error. And how do you weight what weight you give to the diagnostic testing as opposed to your instinct and your feelings about this person who's in front of you and how well these test results seem to align with the reality in front of you?
Well, I think you touched on a key thing, which is that all tests have limits and anything can happen in anybody at any time, mm-hmm. maybe for the first time. And that's where the science, on one hand, is so important because, and I've put stories like this in the book, but just because you haven't, it isn't the big way that they present this disease in the textbook doesn't mean it couldn't be the way it's presenting in that woman because she has a constellation of organ systems. She could be the only one that right now, this is what's caused part of her immune system to, fall out of the bottom. You have to remember that at all times. Again, that should be part of the fascination with the science and the person in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
But that gets lost in the shuffle because people get into that groupthink. Physicians forget that no matter what somebody else has said is the cause of these complex symptoms, you have to start as the first. You have to start fresh as a doctor and close your mind to what other people have said to a certain degree because you might be not thinking as openly as you need to. When I'm talking to people about tests, and we've got a funny, they've got something going on that's painful, that's frightening, that's disabling. So we're trying to get to the bottom of a complex problem. I tell them, here's the test I would start with, and here's why. And one of the simplest things is to think that is doing this test going to change the diagnosis or the treatment? Now, in the beginning of testing, obviously a lot of those things could change the diagnosis. They can either clinch it or say no, but it's not
mm-hmm.
this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good reason to be doing a test. If the treatment wouldn't change, if you did the treatment or if you tried this particular way of working with the symptoms and you didn't do this other test for 2 weeks, would anything be lost? then you might not be needing to do the test. And a lot of these are, I'm thinking maybe more even of some of the x-rays that get done. And so if you really know the science and you've really paid attention to the pain and what's happening in the person, you usually, patients will work with you if you explain, here's why I would do this test, but here's why I would wait to do this one. And if it makes sense to them, then you go ahead with that plan. But when somebody comes back and there's pain and symptoms and all of the symptoms this woman was complaining of are still there, and you've worked your way through the chain of command of fancier and fancier tests, you do have to think, would the treatment change things? Would trying the treatment be a safe thing to do right now? And it sounds like finally somebody was smart enough and dug their heels in the hospital and said, you know, why don't we do this? The treatment isn't deadly, and it may make all the difference. Mm-hmm. And because otherwise, except for that funny little lab test, those couple of lab tests, which we could explain by her immune system not reacting or being overstressed, so maybe it's not showing these markers, mm-hmm. then you try the treatment. And the problem, again, is the pressure on physicians in a group, and it's hard for good physicians, it's hard for them to be the outlier and stick their neck out, because mm-hmm. doctors in groups are just as tricky as people in groups and anything else.
So for anyone, it's difficult to disagree with your colleagues or disagree with what seems to be the evidence to the contrary. Let's take a tiny break here, and we'll be back to talk some more with Dr. Hollenbeck about the usefulness of tests and the role that tests play in making a diagnosis. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back. Thank you.
This is Keith Richards, a.k.a. Just Saying. Is there cancer in your family? There is in mine, but it doesn't have to be bad. We can take action to protect ourselves. I've learned how to get screened and manage my health so that I'll live a long, healthy life. How about you? Visit www.powerfulpatient.org. Again, that's www.powerfulpatient.org. Peace.
We're back now speaking with Dr. Phyllis Hollenbeck about her book, The Sacred Trust. And right now we're talking about the role of diagnostic testing in making a diagnosis.
You know, I've also found it so true that lab tests are so limited. I explain to people lab tests can only measure so much. Something has to get to a measurable amount. Mm-hmm. Those tests get better all the time. They get fancier and fancier. We can detect underactive thyroid at a much earlier point than we could 30 years ago. But x-rays, people need to understand x-rays aren't all, you know, they're not all perfect. Certain x-rays measure or take pictures of certain things with greater or lesser degrees of detail, and they all have their place. They don't all need to be used all at once. But just to circle in a broad way back, a long answer to the story about the woman with Lyme, it's wonderful to hear that somebody did, you know, finally take a chance with her. Because giving antibiotics, yes, there are side effects, but compared to the symptoms I would assume she had,
yeah.
It was a greater good was to try that, and it was less misery for her.
To what extent do insurance companies or whatever constrain the ability of a doctor to take that chance?
Well, I have to be honest with you. I don't think the insurance companies, they're not my, I don't like them. So, and because I'm going to say that first, but they're not as big, you know, a gorilla as sometimes people think. I've found that if you want to have something done and you're thinking it through as a good physician, that the medical directors of those programs are not going to say, oh, no, you can't do this MRI. And when I've had something that was a little out of the ordinary, you know, and I've had to talk to the medical director, and sometimes we make fun of those people a little in medicine because they're not seeing real patients anymore. But some of those are very experienced people who are also trying to get their hand in to make the insurance companies, you know, connected to doctors better. But if you explain it to the medical director and it makes sense, they'll say, yeah, you're right. That sounds like that test could make a difference in treatment or diagnosis. Now, when you get to the to the, you know, more innovative treatments, when you get to the scarier parts of certain cancer treatments, transplants, etc., you are going to find that they all have rules, and they are going to look at certain things as experimental or not. I think the problem then is not so much that the insurance companies are all cold-hearted. They're businesses, and we all need to remember it's a profit and loss. What we're talking about there is that bigger issue of how does a society take care of all? How do we set up a healthcare system, an ability for everybody to get, you know, reasonable care, and for those that get extremely sick to not be bankrupted by it? But of course, that's a you know, that's out there with the election, and the I don't have the answer. I will say, whatever system they want to, however they want to have people pay for medical care, or the government, or how we want to make it work, finally, we do need to have primary care there, right in the center, because you know, we need more primary care physicians.
Right, and I agree with you. I think a lot of people think that this primary care physician in particular is just the gatekeeper and a kind of an annoyance. I have to go see them before I can see the specialist. But on the other hand, as you've been describing it in the last hour, we need that person to see the bigger picture. We need that person to have the relationship with us, to understand that this is a rational human being. So when we go in sometime and we're not so rational, that you have the perspective to say, wait a minute, this is unusual for her, and I need to really listen to what's the difference.
Right, right. I have a couple of stories in the book about, you know, so much information being that this person never complained, usually, was too stoic. I think that people don't realize, but this is still true from when I was first in my training 30 years ago, a well-trained primary care physician, whether it's internists for adults, pediatricians for kids, or family physicians who do, you know, the continuum of adults and children, and sometimes continue with obstetrics. I did that for a number of years and then stopped. But that person, well-trained, can take care of 90% of most of the complaints that, you know, are that people have. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing about being an excellent primary care physician is knowing when the one is kind of, you know, poking at your eye there that you're not supposed to ignore. But you also then should be presenting a package to the subspecialist or to the person who can now do the test that you need. You know, you need the scope put down into the gastrointestinal tract. Well, there's a person who only does that. This is when we need their talent. Mm. Now, you're going to get a lot more out of your visit with them. They, if they're a good physician, are going to feel a lot better about working with a colleague who's presented them information. Here's the story I got. Here's what we've tried. Here's what hasn't worked. Here's what my thoughts are. And the patient and I, you know, but here's my thoughts. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, is then do this test because it might change the diagnosis or treatment. So that's the way to use our subspecialists. It's much better care because they're not perfect, and if they don't get the right amount of information, they can be in a hurry and can miss an important symptom or sign also.
Right, so, and in a sense, they're putting you under a microscope. They're looking just at the one body part. They're seeing you for the first time in your life, and there is no relationship there. So they could very well miss that you're feeling the pain in their area, but in fact, the pain originated, I don't know, in your spinal column or something. It's all connected, and the pain might, in fact, be seated somewhere outside their specialty.
Exactly. Area. Now, the very excellent subspecialists, and I know them, they are those Renaissance people also, they will send a patient back and say, you know, gee, I don't think it's this. I did this test. It's normal. But I'm just wondering, I don't do this type of medicine anymore. I've even had a letter, and they'll say, but, you know, maybe it's related to something behind the gallbladder, et cetera, you know, those kinds of things.
Right.
I like to think that I've been scratching my head to think of everything I could also, but I appreciate them. Then, you know, the conversation comes back from them, and then I go, I've been gnawing at it, and I think, huh, well, maybe it's this, you know, this could be happening, even though this isn't what the book always says, because patients' bodies don't read the book. They don't know the medical textbook says they're not allowed to do this. They just do it. So I like the idea of working in conjunction as a team with the subspecialist. I think that my responsibility is great to be the captain of the ship and to keep integrating the information, making sure it's helping the patient, making sure the patient understands it. I shouldn't have to explain what the subspecialist should have explained, but I can piggyback on it and explain it again. And I think when people don't have a primary care physician and they get a pain sort of right, in the pit of your stomach, right underneath the rib cage in the center, you won't know necessarily which kind of doctor to call.
Right.
Is it your heart? Is it your lung? Is it
right.
your gut? Is it something in your back? Because, I won't go on and on. But there's things that could be related to the big branch of the aorta inside the back,
right.
Inside your trunk going, that are the cause of some pain you might be feeling in the front or back. But that's the kind of thing you don't want patients to have to think, what kind of doctor do I go through the yellow pages for?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't I just bring my whole self in and say, Dr. Hollenbeck, this is where it hurts. And you take it with me, you work with me from there.
This is perfect. I mean, I love what you're saying. And if every GP created teamwork with the specialists, it would be a wonderful world. I mean, where did somebody find a doctor like you?
Well,
it's very hard to go through the yellow pages or through the list of physicians in your healthcare plan and say, yep, I want one of those.
Yeah, it is. It is. Whenever I've moved, it's hard for me to find a doctor. And it's not because I'm so wonderful. It's just that I know what kind of doctor I try to be, and I know what I'm looking for. And I'm a really tough audience as a patient.
Right.
What I always do is ask somebody I know, and sometimes it takes you a little while to get, you're at a new job, but eventually you usually meet somebody who has your sense of humor, seems to have your sense of what health is about, and I think sometimes you do have to go interview a physician. If you can pay for the copay, because those copays are going through the roof. But it's important to do that, and I've had people come in and they say, I'm checking out a couple different physicians, and I always say, you're coming to see a strange doctor today, and you didn't know how strange or not, right?
So, right.
I tell people, that's great, I hope, tell me if I pass the test or not, but I'm just going to be myself. There are a lot of wonderful people out there in medicine. They often don't get credit because they don't get to be the top of the, they're not the chief of staff always because they don't play the politics, and that's not their interest.
Mm-hmm.
They're people who stick their neck out and say things that aren't popular sometimes. They're the one who might have said, why don't we try the IV antibiotics for this woman? Maybe she has Lyme, and why don't we do that? There are people who get kind of beaten down sometimes by the system of medicine and the bureaucracy and the culture of medicine with the egos. But they're out there, and they need to be applauded. And a lot of them are still hanging in there, but a lot of them are really worn out by this, you've got to see a patient every 17 seconds. And that all has to do with the business of medicine, and it has to do also with not paying primary care doctors very much per minute. Another long discussion. I tell people, also go to the websites of, say, your healthcare plan has a couple of different groups that they offer, and go to the site of that group practice. Everybody's got a lot of information on websites now. They'll see how professional the website seems, see whether you can find out information about the doctors. There should be a biography, often a picture. You can't always tell a picture or doctor by their picture, but often you can get a little sense of personality. And that's important.
And the kinds of comments that they make on their website, maybe too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because we're all asked, what do we want to say about ourselves? And so you do get a sense of them. And I know I've been in meetings. This is absolutely a true story where the public relations director comes in and says they're going to upgrade the website, and they want everybody to kind of write a little blurb about themselves. And one of the people who I think perhaps needed a little remedial human training said, well, why do we have to put anything about ourselves? I mean, why don't we just put where we went to school? And why can't that be enough for patients? And the PR director said, well, actually people, God bless them, they assume competence. So they assume you've all gone to reputable medical schools. And yes, the name might be interesting because maybe they grew up in Baltimore and they like to know, that you went to Johns Hopkins. But he said what they're really looking for is whether you're a human being or not. And, you know, that was a that was a pushy thing for the PR director to say. But that's exactly what people are looking for. Because as we started off the conversation, people are trusting. They assume the doctor knows what they're doing. They just want to know what kind of person and who is doing this to them.
Right, and if they're putting their one and only body in your hands, they want to know that they're going to be handled carefully and with respect and brought to the right conclusions.
Absolutely.
Not the conclusion that's the most common, but the right conclusion for them today.
Right, and that's why it's, you know, as the title of the book, it's Sacred Trust.
Mm-hmm.
That's as simple and as big as it is.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the very positive impact you're having in your corner of the world.
Thank you. All, you know, one person at a time, that's all we can do, each
that's
of us.
Right.
Thank you for having me on your show.
My pleasure.
And thank you for being with us again this week, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week as well. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient.